Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schankelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson. And Fred and I have been talking about a subject about which we feel quite a bit of passion, which is the subject of teaching reliability. We're thinking that most everybody in your career at some point will be called upon to do some teaching. And so we've been sharing ideas about this, and we'd love to continue that that conversation.
I thought you were going to talk about the Detroit Red Wings. That's
Nope,
that's not it. Okay. No, I agree. It's in our last episode, we talked about that to be a good teacher. I mean, part of it, I don't think we stated it clearly enough in the last episode, Carl, is that you need to be aware that you are a teacher or or a mentor or a coach or an advisor. There's so many different roles we take on in our professional work. And last episode, we talked more about teaching, doing a class, right? Whether we're doing an internal webinar, we're doing a sit-down class, or we're in a team meeting and somebody says, so what is this accelerated testing thing? And you got to talk to it. Those are all teaching moments type of things. Yet I think it extends well beyond that, because you could be one-on-one with somebody or with a vendor or whoever, and they say, so what is, you just showed me this data analysis and this plot. What's that mean? How do you interpret that? Where'd that come from? Those are all teaching moments in my mind.
Yeah, there's a broader definition of teaching, which is a conveyance of knowledge. And it doesn't require a course setting where you have everybody sitting at a desk, and you have a projector, that type of thing. So there's that broader definition. And there's also a word, and I don't even know if I can define it. But it's the subject of coach. Mm-hmm. And coaching often is one-on-one, where you're working with someone to improve their skills. You act like a coach, whereas teaching tends to be more in an environment with more than one person. But in the broader definition, you could teach one person. And so those words probably have some overlap.
Well, there's, speaking of the Detroit Red Wings, they have a coach that's coaching that group of people. So I think it goes both ways. But I get your point is that I separate teaching and coaching. As teaching is there's a body of knowledge, there's a technique or a procedure or terms or process or subject that we want to increase the knowledge of the participants, of the students. And so it's transferring knowledge, essentially, right? Conveying knowledge to a larger group in a structured way of some form or another. And then coaching is, I think of it as the remember the books about Socrates or of Socrates and the school in, I think it was in Athens, where it was the Socratic method?
Socratic method, yes.
Right. Where that's what I think of when I'm thinking of coaching is how do you set up the questions or the experience or the circumstances so that the person discovers it for themselves, that they pull out the knowledge or they wrestle with the subject or they are able to envision where they could go and then work to overcome the barriers or obstacles to get there. I look at coaching more in that realm.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's a good insight. I think, I'm, as often happens on these SORs, I'm learning as we talk and I'm kind of seeing things that I hadn't thought about, is I definitely bring in that Socratic method to the teaching environment. And so maybe I'm not differentiating between teaching and coaching, mm-hmm. because I think the best way for the student to learn and the best way for me to convey knowledge is to stimulate that critical thinking that's at the essence of the Socratic method, mm-hmm. where Socrates would in the stories we read about Socrates, would stimulate discussion by asking questions.
That's right.
And I think that's a great teaching technique.
It is. And we do that, you know, in classrooms, we have exercises and if they're, or case studies, and if they're well crafted, they present something that sets up a discussion that we can explore, or sets up a circumstance that they have to go wrestle with, or, you know, sort out, or we even just ask a question. It's not necessarily a leading question, but it's aimed towards a point or an idea that we want the student to recognize and realize and wrestle with and struggle with and move on. Now, a hard part of all this is, whether it's coaching or teaching, is that it has to be at a, if I asked you to, so Carl, what's the appropriate settings on a nuclear submarine so that we can run for 6 months? That's beyond wrestling with or setting up, right? Mm-hmm. You know, indeed. It might not be the best example, but knowing that you don't have, I don't know, I don't suspect you were in the Navy on a nuclear submarine.
No.
Okay. So.
No, but I have taught in a naval environment, nuclear submarine maintenance people. So I have that little bit of experience.
Well, I may have told this story before. I was teaching a class, an engineering management class at NASA, at one of their facilities, the one in Houston. And at some point, I'm going through reliability statistics and a bunch of the mathematics and everything else. And I knew they were struggling with this in some of the concepts of CDF and PDF and, you know, all the different functions that we deal with. And I stopped and looked at him and put my hand on my hip and go, "Now, come on, guys. I know you're all, this is not that tough. It's not rocket science." And then I realized, wait a sec, I'm talking to a bunch of rocket scientists.
Yeah. It is rocket science in this one example.
But, for rocket science, they knew that stuff. They've been trained mm-hmm. in it. They understood it. They grappled with it. This was new material for them. So it was out of context for them. And so I had to step back and take smaller steps and bring them along to it. I think a big part of what we do in transferring knowledge is recognizing where our students are, what can we build on and latch on. And it goes to brain science, from what I understand, is that, and you talked about it in the last episode, Carl, is that the getting students into the discussion and dialogue and getting it to have them, you know, rephrase it in their own terms, some concept, it helps them to build it into what they already know, to relate it, to connect it to those elements. And I think that's a part of being conscious as a teacher or a coach.
It does. It is. I'm thinking that when I develop a new class or even try to improve on course material, I'm always balancing the theory with examples and with exercises and with lots of questions and answers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think if you get out of kilter on any of those, like you try to jam in too much theory before you've had a chance to provide examples and before you've had exercises and allowing the student to put it in their own words. I think if you get those things out of balance, that students will tune out. Mm-hmm. There's almost like an ideal relationship between the presentation of theory, the relating it to examples that are in their own language or their own systems. Right. In other words, not purely theoretical examples. Mm-hmm. And then allowing time for exercises where they can practice and one-on-one or in group settings, mm-hmm. and then Q&A. If you get any of those out of balance, then I don't think the course goes as well.
Yeah, it's very true. But the same applies when you're doing one-on-one, when you're working with individuals. And,
yeah,
you know, it's somebody says, well, you know, you just did this data analysis. Why? How did you get that result? Why are you saying that it won't last for 10 years? You know, that 40% are going to fail by 10 years. How did you get there? And the first check is, well, how familiar are they with data analysis in general, or the source of the data, or are they interested in the steps and mechanisms, or are they interested in the interpretation of those little squiggles on the chart? Oftentimes the start of teaching, using the term in the broadest possible sense, is asking questions, and not necessarily from the Socratic approach. I might convert to that depending on where we're going and where they're starting from and what can we build on. But it's, I need to adjust my answer to where they are. And it's a danger that I've seen many reliability engineers get into, is that they, if you've been working in the field and doing lots and lots of data analysis, for example, or doing lots of testing and doing lots of failure analysis and so on, you come into a meeting and go, oh, that's obvious. And it's absolutely not obvious to anybody else in the room.
Right. So you're talking over their heads. Yeah. I think we're distilling different principles, and that this is a good one you've outlined here, Fred, is know your audience, know what they know who they are, what they're interested in, what their capabilities are, and then tailor your material, or if you can't tailor the material, tailor your approach and emphasis that'll meet where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And likewise, you can answer with too much, right? I've heard it a couple of times. Wait a minute. I don't need a PhD thesis on this. I just need to know, is it good or not? I don't need all the everything else. And, you know, somebody says, so what's the results of your environmental testing? Well, in the beginning, during the ice age, and, you know, no, that's not the question. We've got to answer the question.
Well, you know, interesting topic that I'd be interested in your views on this, Fred, and our listeners as well, is when you're in a teaching environment, how willing are you to go off script? Let me set the table here, and then I want to hear your thoughts on this. Is if you go too far off script, you're going to blow up your agenda and you're not going to get done with your slides and that type of thing. But if you're not willing to go off script a little bit, then you're not really answering people's questions. So where do you draw that line?
Well, I don't believe a criteria for a good class or a good teaching or a good coaching is to finish the slides. I have to disagree with that to start with. Now, yeah, I've spent all kinds of time setting it up and putting it together and doing all this material. Like in the webinars I do monthly with the Sendo, is if we get a pile of questions halfway through it and we go off script, I'll go to a blank page and just draw stuff if I need anything visual and skip the rest of the slides. Mm-hmm. Right. That class at NASA that I mentioned earlier, my laptop failed one afternoon. And and the feedback I got on the class critique and all the other good stuff at the end of it was the best session of the class was when your laptop failed.
Oh, no. What does that tell you?
Well, it was instead of scripted, right? And you know my style. I don't have a whole lot of scripting going on the slides. They're prompts for topics, essentially. But I still had the slides on a piece of paper in front of me, but I went to the board and I did much more interaction and engagement and more back and forth with students. It changed the tenor of the class dramatically when I stopped using the slides.
Very nice.
Which is a takeaway that I've used ever
since. You
might
be surprised on this. I completely agree on the subject. The objective is not to get through the slides. The last class I taught in December, I did not finish the slides, and it went very well. Mm-hmm. In other words, I decided we were going to emphasize certain things, and I was going to be sure the students understood certain things. And in order to do that, it took more time than was allocated for the modules. And so a couple of the modules ended up just being transferred by PDF to the students for self-study. But the extra time we devoted on an area that was essentially off script was very meaningful.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's part of knowing your audience is what we really started with, right? If you want to convey information to somebody else, it's got to be useful for them. It's not, I need to tell you these three things. 1, 2, 3. There, got it?
Yeah.
Right? It's got to be something that they need to use or need to incorporate or need to know, whatever. So you got it. You got to know where your audience is and what they need if you're going to teach them something. And
great.
That goes all over the map.
It does. Here's another question for you. How much of communication between you and the students, now I'm really looking at the students' communication, is verbal and how much is nonverbal?
Oh, geez. Yeah. There's a huge preference to doing classes live because vast majority of the way people communicate is nonverbal. And you know this, right?
Yeah.
And while I was at HP, we got a pile of training about how to work with a group to understand, are they getting it? Are they struggling? Is this making sense? Are we losing attention? And it's all body language. You know,
it is.
And you can see it in an audience. Whenever you're dealing with more than one person, then there are techniques that transfer it even to one-on-one communications. The simplest one is breathing. It's harder to see, except if and you've seen it, Carl, you're in a conference room and it's the first day of the conference and it's like a new conference. Remember the first ARS conference? We really didn't know what was to be expected or how it was going to work or how formal or informal it was or like the seminars that Dr. Casey Ciaglu did at Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
The room would be a different feel to it. And if the audience is not comfortable, they're not safe, right? They breathe higher. They take shallower breaths. Their heads don't move. So as you look at an audience and there's no movement, no swaying with the breeze, is to use an analogy,
mm-hmm.
things aren't right yet. They need to know what the agenda is, what to expect, how the format's going to be. Are they going to be asked questions? What happens when you ask a question? Is that work or not? And then you'll see people relax. And, this is the right place. I'm in the right conference. Like, hopefully, earlier this week, when this episode comes out, we're just wrapping up with RAMS. Hopefully, we see a lot of people smiling, taking notes, mm-hmm. looking at us, asking questions.
There's a little bit of a head nod where people are sort of tracking with you.
That's right.
This is such an important subject. If you're listening to this and thinking of doing some teaching, pay attention to the reaction from the students or the people in the room. Do they have a puzzled look on their face?
All the way to they'll get up and leave. That's a pretty bad reaction. But
are they starting to have side conversations? Are they? Is their head nodding the way that says no, they disagree, as opposed to yes, they do agree? Mm-hmm, and what I do is when I see those puzzled looks, or I see the head nodding the wrong way, I'll call on them not to call them out, but to just inquire, Joe, what do you think?
Mm-hmm,
and Joe will bring up the puzzle that he has in his mind. And so that the body language from the student can be the beginning of a conversation that will help them understand what you're trying to say.
And it's just paying attention if somebody crosses their arms and kind of frowns and something, I mean, it can be very, very obvious. The mm-hmm. more you pay attention, the more subtle clues you can pick up to where you can detect somebody is struggling or has a different interpretation of what's going on, or something else is going on in the room and you might not always know what it is, but you can hopefully reveal it before it becomes a problem.
Yes.
And so that takes lots and lots of practice. And I had the advantage of lots of training in that and practice in that. Yet it's in order to get the information across, and this is one of those back to those principles, is that it's got to be safe for yes. them to engage. And we've talked about the engagement and questioning and back and forth and all those other pieces to help internalize the knowledge as it goes across. Yet, if they're looking for the fire exit and in wondering if their job's on the line later in the day, or you know their car's out of gas and they're worried about the parking ticket they just got, and I mean, there's so many other factors that can alter that ability for somebody to learn something.
And that safe environment. I had a class last year that I taught where my contact, we had already had 20 students. And my contact said he would like the managers just to sit in. There were six managers. He would like them just to sit in the back.
And you didn't say no?
And I said no. I absolutely said no, because I did not want the students to feel like the managers were watching them.
Oh, you could put them on high stools in the back
exactly.
with binoculars. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know what's going to happen then? The students are going to say, they're going to not ask questions that make them look dumb. Now, nobody likes to look like they don't know what's happening, but it has to be safe enough that you actually reveal to the people that I don't know something.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
why you're asking a question.
That's right.
So your safe comment is really important. It's what I would call a learning environment. And I went as far in one class where I just wasn't comfortable that people were safe
mm-hmm.
and they weren't asking enough questions. At the end of the day, I went around the room and I said, I went to each person. And I said, hello, Mary, how is it going today? Is it going all right? Are you learning what she came to? And she said, well, yes, but.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then opened up the problem that wasn't getting addressed. And I went around the room like that. And by the time I was done, I knew exactly what to do on the next day.
Yep. Yep. I'm just thinking of one circumstance. It's, I was teaching a week-long class, and on Thursday afternoon, the door opened, and one of the managers pulled out a couple of the other managers that worked for him. And then they came back, and then more people got called out, and they did not come back. And you could see the tension in the room just went through the roof. And I said, what's going yeah. on? And he says, oh, we're doing a layoff.
Oh, jeez.
All right, well, let's skip this for the rest of the day. How can I, you know, what do you need to know? What do you need to do now to be mm-hmm. good? And let's, you know, we're going to come back tomorrow. But the first thing I did was, all right, what's the status? Where are you guys at? You know, what are we going to do today? And then we reset the agenda to focus on. At that point, it was all done that afternoon prior. Right. And so all the people there knew they were safe. And it was like, all right, do we need to take longer breaks so that you can, you know, do other things or, you know, but you could see it. It was just phenomenally immediate how
yes,
fast
indeed.
That class changed. And they were not there anymore. They were all sitting there, but they were not.
Their heads were not in the game. And that's so important is that I remember this from Boys in the Boat, I think it is, the book from Seattle to the Olympics in 1932, which was rowing.
Okay, yeah,
Olympics.
Yeah.
And the Boys in the Boat book talked about mind in boat, MIB.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
the coxswain would say, MIB. The whole point being is your mind needs to be in the activity you're doing. If the student's mind is in the classroom, you're going to see it in their body language. You're going to see it in their mannerisms. And so as an instructor, you have to be able to observe these things and shift gears if you need to. Fred, I had one other thought to the question I asked you about how much you go off script.
Right.
But I just wanted to share this with people. When a student asks a question that I think is important but not relevant to the rest of the students, I'll set up an after hours. So I any class I teach, I set aside an hour at least afterwards for unique topics.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone brings up something that is important but is not really appropriate for the whole class, like I'm teaching a class on FMEA and they want to know about some other subject, then I will do one-on-one time with them, or I'll say, whoever wants to attend, we have this special subject. And that way I'm not I'm not stultifying, if that's the right word. I'm not.
You're not dismissing it as a subject all outright, and which will shut off other questions of any kind.
Yes.
And I mean, people have used techniques of putting it on a parking lot, and we'll get back to that. Or if we have time, mm-hmm. we could adjust to it. But you've done this enough that you're going, no, I'm just going to stay, you know? And
yeah.
And we'll do it at lunch or whatever.
Sometimes don't get followed up.
That's right. And having a mechanism to deal with the off topics. And then other times you get a discussion that goes down a rat hole, and recognizing that and saying, all right, come on back now.
Let's get back out of the hole.
Yeah. So, and it goes all over the map. And I don't know whether we answered the separation between coaching and teaching and mentoring and all the other ones, because to me, they are synonyms, and you can name them whatever you want for your local culture or situation.
Let me just offer one more thing. I know we're on wrap up on this one because we're probably up against the time, but I wanted to share one more point is stories. And I know you do this, Fred, and I do it. But if you're new, you need to develop your repertoire of stories.
Yep.
And I mentored a number of people in a teaching environment where I mentored them to teach. So they would sit in on my classes and they'd go, well, Carl, what do? I don't have those same stories. Well, I said, okay, use my stories if you need to.
That's
in other words, I heard this story and then tell them. You don't have to say it's not your own. Or I mean, you can say it's not your own and where it come from if you want. But stories are so important to convey knowledge.
They are.
It's so much better than just the words on the slide.
Yeah, I think we ended the last session or last speaking of reliability episode with the same comment I'm going about to make is like, well, that's a subject for another whole.
Yes.
Because telling the same story over and over, it doesn't serve the purpose. It has to be tailored to that circumstance. And so that before we go off to that, as people are in their parking lot waiting for us to stop yapping and get on with the rest of their day. Let's leave it open. So if the listener, I mean, how do you view stories as a way to communicate? What's your take on that? And where is it appropriate or not appropriate? It might be a way to open that up. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a feedback form there. We'd love to hear from you. And if you tell us a story, that'd be even better. give us a chance. But we would love to hear from you because we do learn quite a bit all the time about you as the audience when you choose to get in touch with us. And we certainly look forward to that. And so with that, Carl, let's wrap this one up and make some notes about other episodes.
Very good, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later, Carl.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.